Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 10th of November. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And I'm Charles Archer.
Welcome all. What a week. Is there anything else that we can talk about, I guess? History made with the first convicted felon installed in the White House as president.
You went with that straight away.
What did I say last week on the roast? Clean sweep.
I think I was going for more of a wishful thinking side of things. You know what I mean? But what are the thoughts on it initially? What is the general consensus in the UK? Would you say
in the UK the general consensus is
what have we woken up to?
Well, maybe we've got enough of our own problems. You can deal with those, you know. But I think in terms of like UK politicians, Keir Starmer, David Lammy, Trump is not their friend, right? So they've kind of shot themselves in the foot, just being politically incompetent from day one. And now that it's a really funny situation where reform potentially is going to have the backing of the US government in the next election, whether you want to believe that or not. Now, in terms of the actual election itself, I mean, Trump got 3 million less votes than in 2020. And Harris received 13 million less votes than Biden did in 2020. And then the top trending Google search on election day was, where can I vote for Joe Biden? So he lost his incumbent advantage. And I wonder whether, had Joe Biden died, right, and they wheeled out his corpse and they said, just vote for this guy, he would have done better.
Don't sit on the fence here, Charles.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, it's simple though, isn't it? Like Biden had, and they replaced him because he's going, he's senile, right? Which is fair enough. But actually, they probably would have done better just keeping him. Yeah. I think
the questions I've got is, was this too much of a weak, drive from Harris? Or was this, I think this is very similar to the UK in almost the Brexit vote and almost the vote for change. When they interviewed most of the American, on the exit polls, it seemed something like 8 out of 10 of those that were interviewed said this was an economic, this was a decision based on their own
economic
person. Yeah, exactly. So was this, did they think that, they've been in, Biden has done pretty much nothing, they've all suffering. And we spoke to an American this week and he said, you got to remember, for the last 5 to 8 years, Americans like the UK have been out of pocket and they've been suffering with the cost of living crisis. So this was a vote for change, is the way I see it.
Yeah, 100%. And then the other issue is migration at the southern border.
Yeah.
Highest migration ever. And the Americans don't want it. And it's pretty much the lesson there in the UK with the channel migrants. And this it doesn't matter about the politics. The basic point is, there's a very large number of people in both UK and the USA that don't want illegal migration or refugees, depending on your perspective. And if you don't address those people, then you will lose elections. But yeah, I think what it is is that the Democrat voters just didn't turn up this time for the Democrats. I understand that, but I do think it's we're now in a sort of, I would say, a dangerous position with the US, because the Constitution is designed to separate the powers, right? The executive, the president, the legislature in terms of the Supreme Court, and then the judicial Supreme Court and the legislature, which is the House of Representatives and the Senate. And Trump's going to have all of them. And probably a couple more Supreme Court justices are going to retire or die, and he'll pack it even more. Yeah. And I don't like the idea of Donald Trump being able to do whatever he wants. You like to have those checks and balances that just aren't going to be there for him this time around. He can do whatever he likes. What do you reckon, Kev or Phil?
Well, for me, I think it was inevitable for the last number of weeks. I mean, I don't think any system will accept pulling somebody from running and not having a vote to see who's the next one.
Mm.
In other words, just slamming Kamala Harris. And to be honest, what did she offer? She didn't offer any policies.
No.
She didn't offer a way forward for the US.
She was
economy.
Running the female vote with abortion. That was about
it.
Really.
Yeah. It was like, come and have your abortion on the last day of your pregnancy. Everything's okay.
Yeah.
We protect your body and we protect your rights. Well, that will work for a small portion of the people. And Trump basically took the sting out of that one anyway by saying, we're going to let every state decide. Okay. So we're not going to be, of the mind that We will ban abortions, etc., etc. And in certain cases, I don't think we should have abortion. Oh, sorry, we should ban abortion. It should be available in certain
Yeah, cases.
criteria.
Yeah.
Okay, but the fact is that the Democrats changed on the abortion issue from the right to control our bodies to we wholly support abortion. So it even changed from, whatever word you want to use to yes, you can kill your unborn baby. Okay. And they were getting more and more and more radical on that point, which was taking them more and more and more away from the common sense electorate. And that's what happened. And I do think, yes, that the Democrats basically have made life more difficult for Americans as a whole. And therefore there was a vote that said, well, whoever the opposition is, however I don't like the personality,
Right.
I'll go for it. To answer your other question about the UK, well, I think we're in a bad position
Yeah, we
because
are.
basically Starmer is the sort of the anti-Trump. And I mean, to even send Labour people over there to help the Democrats is ridiculous. I mean, how he allowed them to do that or even didn't chastise them for doing it. It's interference in someone else's election. Can you imagine if we had 100 Democratic, people over in the UK saying vote Labour? Well, how would we react?
Do you know who the big winner is for this, Kev?
I know.
I think Farage and the Reform Party are
No, he is.
because
The question you've got to pose though is, will we have a new party at some point in power? So will the Conservatives roll over and let Farage come in and actually take over? Because otherwise we'll have a three-party system and it'll be a disaster.
I think there's every possibility that in 4 3.5 4 years, when the next election, that reform could really, really, because Starmer is on his way to becoming one of the most hated prime ministers in history right now. With the things that are going on, the latest budget, etc., and just his general woke attitude. And I think that it's setting up this vacuum for reform to come in.
Quite possibly. But ultimately, the people said, we're not going to trust the Conservatives anymore. And therefore, we're going to vote Labour. Because if I remember the numbers, Labour didn't get particularly any more votes, did they, in this general election?
No, I think they've got, yeah, they didn't.
Maybe a few
It
more
was...
than they did the last time, but they have a landslide. So why did that happen? Because Reform took a big chunk off Conservative. So the question is, can Reform be the next party? Who knows? What do
Well,
you
I've
think?
got some question. I mean, I think that the big one is the way, and Kev, you've been talking about this, is the way that the Western media and a lot to the Democrats have kind of wound up the biggest fears in a Trump 2.0 presidency. Yeah. So let's just take a look at some of them, and maybe I'll ask you for your opinion. So the first one that they've talked about is the fact that there's going to be potentially bigger tariffs on UK goods. Obviously, concerns of Trump imposing sweeping tariffs, potentially wiping about £3.6 billion off the UK economy as the UK seeks to negotiate a US-UK trade deal to prevent economic damage. What are your thoughts on that? Obviously, that's a big one. He has talked about these tariffs. It's affecting manufacturers, especially in Germany, car manufacturers, and obviously China. What are your thoughts on what the potential damage could be for Westminster on those
Well,
things?
I don't think he'll do it, for one, because he's got to be very careful about importing inflation, and that's what he will do if he goes down this tariff route. Now, does he tariff China on certain things? Yes, in my view, but that is more strategic than saying all of our partners we're going to put tariffs on. I don't see that. I don't. He's going to import inflation. Yes, he wants inflation because he wants a lower value to his debt and he wants a lower value to his dollar. I think he's a clever cookie. I don't care what
He's a businessman at the end of the
his
day, isn't he?
behavior and everything else people don't agree with, and like for sure I don't agree with it, but at the end of the day, he's a business guy. And you look at the people that he's got around him now.
Yeah, this
He's
is, yeah.
got Elon Musk, he's got
Yeah.
Vivek, who is a genius as far as I'm concerned. He's as smart as Elon Musk as far as I'm concerned. And then you've got Bobby Kennedy. Now, you talked about the fact that the Democrats got 13 million less votes. Bobby Kennedy had a big part to play in that, I'm pretty sure, because a lot of his supporters, and it goes in the millions, would have voted Democrat without doubt. and they followed him, and they went and voted for Trump instead because of it. So I don't think the tariff thing. I think it was a bluff, you know, from what he was saying. It's like, I'll do this, I'll do that, I'll do that, which was just much more than the Democrats were saying they were going to do, because they weren't saying anything.
Sure. Charles on tariffs.
Tariffs? Well, I don't know. I mean, the thing to understand with Trump, as Kevin was saying, is that Trump is this individual, you know, as an individual, in terms of his personal ethics are pretty odious in my view. But the team he surrounds himself with, the actual administration, you know, for Americans, his last administration was good. You know, pretty much everything he did is what you would actually want as a citizen of the country. Now, yes, let's say that he, you know, what he wants to cut taxes because Trump loves cutting taxes, right? And if he cuts taxes and goes on a spending binge, demand goes up. If he puts tariffs as well, then yeah, you'll have high inflation. You'll get higher interest rates for longer, means a stronger dollar, bad for debt, and also weaker gold, incidentally. So I don't think he's going to do all of them. And if the choices are, generally you can do two of three, right? Two out of three. So the choices are taxes, spending binge, tariffs, which are the two that, you know, he's most likely to do is probably going to be taxes and the spending binge. The tariffs will be, yeah, like, you know, strategic on China potentially. But at the same time, you know, if he personally dislikes Keir Starmer, which he does, he might choose to single us out. You never know. We were talking about Elon Musk a second ago. I mean, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because Elon backed the right horse, and people don't think in big enough terms. Do you know, he was giving out like $1 million a day to anyone voting in swing states, right? And obviously legal cases and, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Donald Trump gets elected and his personal wealth soared by $26.5 billion in about 3 hours. You know, that's probably the best return on investment ever. Kamala Harris spent $1 billion on her campaign and didn't get elected. It's
Yeah,
probably the
and
worst.
Tesla shares went up about 12% on the news as well. So I mean, what, you know, what it was all done for personal reasons. We know Musk is a very clever cookie, and he's been working on this one. I mean, the first thing he did when he took Twitter over, or X, was to bring Donald Trump's account back from being banned, didn't he? He knew exactly what he
He's
was
planned it
doing.
all out. Yeah, I mean,
He
it's.
has, but did you hear the interview that Musk did on Joe Rogan? And I think it was Joe Rogan. It might not have been Joe Rogan, but it
Yeah,
was an
he
interview
did a Joe Rogan.
about why he was going to support Trump. Because it was because of one of his children got basically changed from boy to girl, I think it was, or girl to boy, I'm not sure which. And they gave him basically sterilization medication without his permission. And then he went on the process then of finding out what this was all about, and realized that this was basically just a Democratic policy, that in California this is what they will do. And he was nearly in tears on this particular podcast, because he was like, I'm coming after them, I'm coming after them, I'm gonna change this. So there are things, I think, very private and very personal with Elon Musk, that he's like, no, this isn't going to happen. I mean, his comments was, this isn't going to happen to other families and other people. It's
I think
just
that's one of
not
them,
going
but
to happen.
there's going to be a lot of personal
Well, I
wealth
mean, there's
reasons
personal and
behind
professional,
it.
isn't there? I mean, like, for example, Trump is, you know, not going to support the EV industry, which you would think is bad for Tesla, but it's good for Tesla because Tesla is in pole position. And if the government starts giving out grant funding to other companies to catch up, that's not going to help. I will say, with a lot of this stuff, you know, the debates on abortion or transgenderism, you know, you can call it cultural stuff, I guess. It will forever and always be a constant battle with nothing ever settled. And this is the problem with it, you know. And for example, I do believe that there's a small number of genuinely transgender people who I feel deep sympathy for. And also, equally, there are going to be women every year who need abortions for whatever reason, whether medical, you know, otherwise. But we now have this society where the people on the right seem to be extremely far right, and people on the left seem to be extremely far left. And so we have these candidates who have generally extreme opinions getting into political power. The majority of the population wouldn't vote for. They just have to pick between who's the furthest left candidate or the furthest right candidate. We don't want either. We want just normal people. We don't seem to have that option in any Western country. It's just madness.
Yeah, no,
Do
I
you
agree
get?
with your sentiment, Charles. But the problem is, politics is always that, well, not always, but in general seems to be, you know, we have to illuminate the divide, don't we? We have to illuminate, you know, this and this. Whereas actually there is a grey middle ground, which is normally what ends up happening, to be honest, in terms of policies and everything else that then get put into place. Because the stuff that, I mean, maybe you're coming on to it, Phil, so I'll shut up, but I mean,
So the other one is obviously the big fear of is Trump pulling the US out of the IMF and World Bank, obviously, which would potentially open the door for China to influence developing nations, and then the UK potentially stepping out but lacking funds. I guess we've kind of we talked a little bit about that. The other one I want to talk about is the sort of tensions. He said that within 24 hours, give me a day, I'll sort out the mess with Russia and Ukraine. Will he withdraw US support for Ukraine, which will obviously risk NATO unity and the global order against Russian aggression? And then how do we feel about the other wars, like that with his relationship with Netanyahu and also China, and I mean there's just an Iran and his attitude. So what do we think he's got the ability to fix a problem like Russia?
I think he's got a better chance of it than almost anyone else on the planet because he's unpredictable, right? So you don't know what he's gonna do. Will he do it in 24 hours? I don't know. I mean, but I genuinely, this is the point, you don't know. So Putin doesn't know, right? And if he goes, oh well, because I see it going one of two ways. Either he says to Ukraine, just accept you've lost this land, the war is over because we're not supporting you anymore, and Germany is collapsing as well, which is the center of Europe, their government is over. So Ukraine will just have to say, okay, fine, right? But if he says to Putin, right, the same deal, right, you're keeping this land, but you go one step further, we're going to provide Ukraine with everything that we've got, and Putin says no, then he may go the other way and just supply Ukraine with everything, you know? So I think we're either going to see, I hope anyway, a lasting peace of some kind relatively soon, or Ukraine properly supplied. And something that really frustrates me about that particular conflict is that the Western world could supply Ukraine with everything it needs to beat back Russia properly, because it is all the technology and an arms race essentially. But we don't. We just give them enough to keep the meat shield going, which is wrong. Or alternatively, you say Ukraine can never win this conflict, which is probably more realistic. But how do we create a peace which we know that Putin won't breach in 5 or 10 years' time?
But we give them everything and then we bring the nuclear button into play. This is the problem, isn't it, really?
Yeah, well, that's the issue, isn't it? Yeah, the
I
further you
mean,
go, the more you escalate.
what I see Trump in Ukraine doing is basically sitting down with Ukraine and saying, and its NATO partners, and saying, we're not giving you any more. We're not giving you any more cash. So if you want to keep funding this, then NATO, Germany, France, UK, etc., etc., stump up your cash because you haven't been stumping up your cash for the
So they
last two
can't.
decades. They can, but they're choosing not to, though they've all been told they have to increase it. And I don't think Trump's wrong in this instance, especially
No,
in
not at
German
all.
situation. Germany have been using the Second World War not as an excuse, but like we will not militarize ourselves, and yet they haven't been putting the percentage into NATO that they probably
It's still
should
in
have.
half, isn't it? Or free, yeah.
Yeah, and they've been putting 1%, 1.5%. The UK is probably the best of the rest.
We're still not doing, no.
Yeah, we need to up to about 3%, I think, from what I can
Yeah.
gather.
Well, I think it's people forget the defense of the realm is actually the most important public service. We forget it in times of peace. But
Yeah.
like our grandparents, even your parents, potentially, but your grandparents, great grandparents, fought in two world wars. The last one only ended, what, 70, 80 years ago. I know obviously that's not stuff that you want to like scare people about. But actually, not having a functioning military is a very bad idea for any country on the planet.
Very bad idea. And then you go on to Israel and Netanyahu, and it's not just Gaza anymore, is it? It's Gaza, Lebanon,
Lebanon, yeah.
and Iran, and
Yemen.
all of those different things. Well, I basically think Trump's going to do the same thing. It's about money. He's ran on, we're not going to pour trillions of dollars into these things when we're not looking after America. And that's been his theme. And I don't think he's going to change his theme. So I think it's going to be Netanyahu. Sorry, mate, stop. Okay. But you in terms of Gaza, stop. In terms of Lebanon, stop. And we don't provide you with the weapons. Halas, you can't do anything.
One super interesting thing, but in terms of obviously we talk about small caps a lot, is what critical minerals and reshoring. If Trump decides to do things like impose tariffs anywhere over the world, or starts to act to try to stop these conflicts and annoy major powers who would like them to continue, then that creates an incentive to keep critical minerals, to keep onshoring them in the US and in North America. And obviously, you know, there's plenty of companies we could name, but I think that'll be a continuing theme, and there's very strong bipartisan support for it. But it's not just critical minerals. It's Taiwan is a good example. China has made it clear they're going to take Taiwan at some point, right? The vast majority of the world's semiconductors are manufactured in Taiwan. So what's the US going to do? They're going to expedite the, you know, semiconductor boundaries in the US. There's plenty of investing opportunities there as well, that, you know, which is going to be quite fun to watch as we go. But I think, I mean,
Trump's attitude on Taiwan's interesting, because he came under comment and said, oh yeah, Taiwan stole all the tech from China and things like that. So he's not that bothered about China just going and running roughshod from what it appears anyway, from his statements.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, China, I mean, I've done lots of analysis on this. I mean, China, when Russia invaded Ukraine, right, Russia just wants the it wants the land, it wants the iron, it wants the wheat fields. But if you invade Taiwan, the only strategic value it has is some semiconductor factories. And if you invade it and it's turtle-shelled itself, you know, then there'll be nothing left on that island by the time China's done with it. So there's no point doing it except to make a point. So it is the eternal sword of Damocles hanging over the global economy. Because if China invades Taiwan, the entire Western world's put sanction on China, and the semiconductor, which is effectively the internet, stops. Which will be quite a fun day. Lots of volatility on that trading day, should it ever happen. But let's hope not.
Well, the trading day might not happen because of the internet.
Because the internet will be down. All my shit. I don't have any papers to do.
So let's hope that you've got a few coins in your safe, or a few things that you can barter with. Because if you don't, then you're not going to have anything.
We'll have to go out into London with like microphones shouting out a Sunday roast. Okay. End of times. Yes. But anyway.
Yeah, and obviously we saw gold, silver and copper prices all experience notable declines in response to the US election victory. Driven by surging dollar and market speculation on potential policy shifts, gold dropped to multi-week lows. Spot gold reached $2,657 per ounce. Silver also declined, affected by the stronger dollar and investor caution. Copper saw a sharp sell-off, plummeting up to 4.3% on the London Metal Exchange and 4.6% on New York's COMEX, hitting $9,389 per ton. This marks copper's largest drop since May as markets assess Trump's trade and geopolitical views, especially regarding potential escalation in the US-China trade war. Analysts caution that further tariffs on imports, particularly from China, could impact demand for metals, although Beijing might counter with stimulus measures. This turbulence presents potential buying opportunities for long-term investors in precious metals as a hedge against economic instability, with analysts predicting eventual rebounds in these markets. And of course, Bitcoin surged to all-time highs of $75,000. No doubt we'll see $100,000 prices in 2025. So, yeah, Charles, over to you first. On metals, what do you make of this gold, silver, copper correction?
Oh, my goodness, Phil. That was a very long, long soliloquy you gave to us. That was lovely. I think gold, I mean, it's come down a bit because the basic point is that if Donald Trump causes inflation, US interest rates will stay higher for longer, and therefore, you know, the US dollar becomes more attractive. Will that stay the case? We don't know. I mean, I suspect that governments will remain addicted to printing money and spending too much, and therefore gold will become more and more of a safe haven. In terms of like metals more widely, I'm not sure if you guys noticed, but China has just announced they're going to refinance a massive amount of their debt in order to boost growth, which could be quite interesting. But I think the basic problem is that the market likes certainty, right? And Donald Trump is not a certain person. His administration is not certain. The one thing that nobody knows what he's going to do, which in terms of metals, it means that it's very difficult for anybody to forward plan for things like inflation or the strength of the US dollar, which are obviously really important when you're talking about like mining, but also in terms of demand as well. And for example, if there's tariffs that are set up between, you know, China and the US, and then China, you know, potentially struggles with its property sector, and then you can't, you know, they have weaker iron ore demand, that filters out to everybody else. You just don't know. And when you don't know what's going to happen, prices fall. That's always the case with metals. I suspect that they'll recover back to where they were, and then it will just be a wait and see kind of thing. But I think by and large, in terms of critical minerals, bipartisan support in the US is very strong for reshoring. And so therefore you're probably going to continue to see prices start to move back up for these things. But the copper supply gap isn't going anywhere, no matter who's in the White House. You know, we know that there's nowhere near enough copper for the demand that's going to be over the next 10 or 20 years. The question is, if you're trading it over the short term, what do you do? Well, the answer is stop doing that, because you don't know with Trump in the White House what's going to happen. You just don't have the certainty anymore. You're better off taking long-term positions in stocks that you think are going to do well at sort of mid to large cap level. And then in some of the higher quality juniors that, you know, we talk about day in, day out. My own soliloquy. What are your thoughts, Kev?
Yeah, I was at, what else do I add to you two professors in terms of this? I think it was an emotional reaction, because it's been proven that when you get a Republican president, the dollar gets stronger. So ultimately it went, or not proven, but it's happened many times. So dollar's gone higher. So the metals correct a bit because of it. I think they've corrected back over the few days, even to see gold going a bit higher again. I think there's absolute uncertainty about what's going to happen in the world. So I think all of them are going to be a good play. I think copper's going to be a great play because of what you've said already, Charles. I think gold is going to be a great play because I think the economies are in effect absolutely, sorry about the dog in the background. Yeah, I think gold is just going to continue to go, to be honest, because we've got inflation. What is gold? Gold is a risk against inflation and actually just protects the value of your money. So where is gold going? I think it's going up even after this year. I don't think it's going up, but I think it will continue to go up. And I think silver will follow it, and I think silver will be more aggressive, I think, in the next 12 months.
Silver's had a good run in the last 3-4 months. It's up from the sort of, well, even from the start of the year, from, was it 22 up to sort of around 32. And there's quite a few, I know Pandora announced issues because of their margins have been smashed, because Pandora is one of the biggest jewelers, you know, in terms of, you know, users of silver. So who are the other losers this week in terms of sectors in this market? You see any others that were affected?
Well, I mean, markets in general just went up, didn't they? So I think there was very few losers. It didn't really have much of an effect on the UK market at all, did it? I mean, whether you're talking about the FTSE, whether you're talking about the AIM stocks did better after the budget than they did after anything to do with this. I mean, the scenario is quite simple, isn't it? We do focus more on resource stocks. That's what we've got. Why we focused on resource stocks? Because in the long term, we perceive that these assets are going to go up in value, either from exploration upside or alternatively from these things just being more required. So if you look across the board, Byzant had a good thing this week, a good RNS this week, just about Hope and God up again. And I think you're going to continually see more and more news from Byzant coming out. And you've got all those other players. I know you did something with Ark Minerals this week, Charles. And Minerals. I mean, you're in a situation where they didn't really say enough, and that's why the share price went down, but then it did start to recover. I think the investors are very optimistic. I mean, there are so many plays there.
So there were two losers this week. Green energy companies took a bit of a beating, obviously, on grounds that there was the push to decarbonize the US economy will potentially slow. And then also German car makers as well. Fears of import restrictions we've alluded to. Porsche and BMW shares fell by more than 6%. So I think the German car makers are obviously feeling a bit of a pinch on that.
The German government is collapsing. The finance minister got fired. The energy costs there are extraordinary. So big problems. But I think on the small cap level, a lot of it is just there's a lot of companies that seem on the verge of material news. And we're all just kind of waiting, whether that's Ark Minerals for assays or Rome Resources for assays or Helix Exploration with, their two projects in Gamar and Rudyard. And more and more, there's probably 10 or 20 we could name where we're all just kind of waiting. And funnily enough, that's something I've noticed, is that they don't release news on Friday anymore, any of these companies. It's like we've decided the market just isn't open on Fridays anymore.
Well, the city, to be honest, going to the city on a Thursday night, you know full well that everybody's in the pub, because Thursday's the new Friday, isn't
Yeah,
it?
it
I
is,
mean,
yeah.
nobody is in the city on a Friday,
So
so.
the only time you release something on Friday is at 6 p.m. when you've got a placing at -50%.
Oh
But
no, don't talk to me about out of
so we
doors
should
ordinances.
should we close the markets then? Should we have this
Hey, you
Monday,
lads.
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, a
It's
all-day
funny.
market
4 day
trading?
weeks are coming. 4 day
Yeah,
weeks
well,
are coming.
it's funny because obviously the US and like the larger stocks are talking about like a 24-hour market going ahead at some, we're already at 22, but I have wondered whether the small cap market would be better served with a 3 day trading week with much higher volumes in those 3 days. Would that not make more? Because at the moment you've got a 5 day week where there's not enough volume each day to create a market. Is that one way to help it? I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it makes it worse, but I think you need to have some kind of change. Maybe it would help.
So let's move on to our first guest this week, Sean Day, MD of Greatland Gold. Welcome back, Sean. How's life treating you?
Really good. Thanks, Phil. And a pleasure to be with you guys again on the Sunday roast.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, before we move on to the recent exploration news we've seen, Sean, I'd like to your take on the US election news and its immediate negative effect on metal prices, please.
Yeah, look, I think Trump's victory was somewhat predictable. I think we might have spoken before. I certainly saw it as the more likely of the two outcomes. The having said, and interestingly, it was betting markets that I think demonstrated that better than the weight of money, better than the opinion poll. But what you also saw in that was, the immediate aftermath. You've seen commodity prices in general fall. But gold has actually held up, very well. I think, both candidates are intending to spend a lot of money. Trump on face value, an unholy amount of money, which presumably is actually supportive of gold in USD terms. But what you also saw initially is, and perhaps for the same reason, the AUD or the FX pairing of Australia currency against the US greenback. The Australian dollar actually went up. So in Aussie dollar terms, the gold price is off a little bit. It's still plus 4,000 with an all-time high of 4,200, but you saw a little bit of a dip in the Australian gold price. We are an Australian currency. But over time, I actually think you're going to see a stronger USD gold price. Limited upside in the Australian dollar vis-a-vis the greenback. So I think over time we're probably going to continue. It's a good time to continue to be a gold producer, and I like being in a currency which is a risk currency, so therefore probably amplifies the benefits of gold.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
you're going to see potential of 5,000 to 6,000 Aussie dollar gold. I don't think it's a million miles away, to be honest. Especially as, I mean, I don't think we can judge on the first few days really of that situation. I think it's more likely that it's going to be inflationary what Trump's going to do for sure. Interest rates are going to stay higher, but he wants to depreciate the value of the dollar. There's no doubt about it, because why wouldn't he? That's what he wants to be more competitive. So can't see any other way that this is going to work out.
And de deflating, yeah. So look, I think, yeah, you're right. So look, well, hopefully you're right. A 5,000 Aussie gold price sounds super attractive. So yeah, it's I think it's a positive environment as far as, whatever your political view, as far as a gold exposure investment is concerned, I think it's a positive time to have gold in your portfolio.
Yeah, absolutely. Be interesting to see how it all pans out, as you say. So obviously, let's move on to the exploration progress. It's interesting to see Greatland continuing with other projects within the Paterson region. We obviously saw recent drilling at Chile Prospect revealing pathfinder mineralization, including a notable 37 meters at 0.21 grams per ton of gold and 0.13% copper from 136 meter depth, with a peak of 1 meters at 6.1 grams per ton of gold. There was also Teague Prospect veining and sulfides intersected with assays pending, and while drilling has also commenced at the London and Bootstrap prospects. strong magnetic and gravity targets at Atlantis are earmarked for future drilling, with the planned acquisition of Havieron Telfer and related assets in Q4. Greatland is set to consolidate 100% stake in Havieron, the Jury project, and Telfer exploration portfolio, increasing its Patterson tenure to 4,500 square kilometres. So just, you know, how do these results at Chile compare with the initial findings in other areas, Sean?
Yeah, look, I think overall what that announcement tells you is that the team is active in the Patterson, and we'll have about 4,500 square kilometers of tenure in the Patterson. I think you're going to see us slowly but surely walk up the amount of activity across our exploration portfolio. That will be in two phases. In mine, exploration is going to be a huge focus for us, but also you're going to see a slow walk up of that, you know, broader, what I'll call greenfields exploration activity, which is what you just described. And without being able to declare kind of, you know, an economic discovery, we like what we achieved there. You know, it's always a good confirmation of your models when you're hitting mineralization. That's what we like about this. There's certainly follow-up. I think I've described before, you know, mostly our techniques are plus or minus 300 meters. So when we look at these opportunities, we go, okay, let's recalibrate, let's rezone in and work out where we want to drill. And that Teague prospect, look, there's some really good looking core coming out of Teague. Yeah, until you've put it through assays, it's always a little bit hard to know. But again, nice to see the kind of brecciation and sulfides sulfides that we're looking for. So overall, a good program, but it continues. So there's rigs spinning as we speak and more work being done. And look, we can't wait to get the keys, but that's only going to help us accelerate that exploration.
Exciting times, exciting times. I mean, how are you balancing the expense of the exploration with getting Telfer, you know, up and running? Because presumably,
it's a great question, Charles, and that's why I was a little bit measured in how I described the acceleration of the exploration spend. You know, there's not going to be like a convoy of rigs just kind of, you know, turning up into the Patterson for that greenfield exploration. But also, what we need to do is build up the team, rank those targets. So there's quite a structured way. But I think what you're going to see is over the next 2 years, just a steady, considered, well-managed build-up of that greenfield exploration. What you might see is a much quicker build-up of the in-mine exploration.
Yeah.
We'll have a couple of rigs, maybe even a couple more rigs on that West Dome deep prospect, but also just in that open pit. Look, we think we have really good visibility on fully drilled out opportunities over the next few years, but we want to continue to build that and build that bow wave of production ahead of us. So, and whether it's $4,000 or hopefully Kevin's, you know, $5,000 an ounce gold price, you know, things look pretty attractive. So, you know, we want to take advantage of that. And so I think, but that's how you build it up. I think an initial focus where that infrastructure already is in mine opportunities.
Yeah.
And then we systematically build that exploration team.
Well, I'm guessing, I mean, the general consensus is, you maybe you can shed some light on this, is that there's a lot more gold at Telfer than there officially is in the numbers at the moment. What are your general feelings on that?
Don't answer that, Sean. Don't answer that. I was going to add on to that question just before you do answer it, okay? Is Rick Rule, we interviewed Rick Rule just a couple of weeks ago, and your company was one of the companies we discussed. And he was basically of the mind that, do you guys have the technical prowess? And he thought you did, by the way, but do you have the technical prowess to make the most of what's there at Telfer? Because actually, his impression was there's a lot more at Telfer.
So
it's the same question, but it's like, are you going to take the time, the money, the effort to make sure you make the most of Telfer, I suppose, was what he was saying. Because if he did, then he sees the upside as huge.
Yeah, so let me answer that in two parts. So there's this initial opportunity for us to on the work we've done to date and the work we continue to do, to provide a JORC resource we think in the March quarter of 2025. So this is only 4 or 5 months ago, and it's subject to us completing the transaction, but we're confident around completion this calendar year, which is an increasingly short number of days. And then two, we'd like to come out with, or, and then in the second part of that question is, look, not only do we inherit the entire team already at Telfer, which in some case has more than a decade individually of experience on that side, but also we augment that with our own team. And we've already put together an updated technical team with resource geology, mining engineering, and processing. And that technical team will effectively drive that process of conversion of that identified resource into mining opportunities. So we've kind of got the full spectrum here, where we want to empower, engage, and fund the exploration, which is an augmentation of our existing team with the team already at place at Telfer. Plus, we've also now completed an expanded technical team that can take that and drive mine planning opportunities and understanding economics. So we feel not only do we have the exploration in good order, we also feel we have the conversion of that into mine plan in good order. So we've invested in that, and we'll continue to invest in that through the drill bit.
Did you answer that?
I was just going to say, did you get an answer there, Kev?
I didn't get an answer at all.
That was politically brilliant, sure.
Yeah.
But do you think there's more gold there or not? That's a yes or
usually
no.
Usually it works, doesn't it? We all just stay silent and just watch the pressure build up for someone to say something. Can't you crap? You didn't wait for him to say so yes, but no.
Nothing like a bit of dead air, is there? A bit of dead air.
No.
Sean's about to click off here.
what I can add to that is, look, yes, we're really confident about the opportunity to be successful in our exploration. And importantly, the higher gold price increases the probability that ounces identified are economic.
Okay, so the next question that comes straight to my mind is then, all that is around Telfer, okay, in terms of the exploration upside there, do we see that they left some juicy opportunities on the table that effectively they just weren't willing to invest the money to make these things work? I mean, I'm not trying to draw something from you. I'm literally just for people who don't understand the potential exploration upside, you know, what is it? Is it a shot in the dark, or is it something much more than that?
No, look, I think if people have a look at the presentation that we have in the market, I think Newmont have been just outstandingly good custodians of this asset over the past 12 months. That they've continued to invest and work forward opportunities. I think if you look at the West Dome Deeps, the Stage 8 extension, the Stage 7 cutback, fully drilled out, well understood. You know, those opportunities, you know, we think we can quickly work on. In the main dome, there's a large opportunity there, again, fully drilled out, that we can work on an expedited basis. And when you go into the underground, you know, it was Newmont that completed the drill drive, or the exploration drill drive, out to West Dome Deeps. They've got two rigs spinning on that. Yeah, that's a hugely exciting area for the mine and a new area. So they've actually not just do I think there is area there, Newmont has actively advanced them for us. So we will be able to take advantage of the great work that Newmont's done, and that will expedite our cycle to be able to articulate that to the market.
Okay, so moving on to Havieron then. Havieron is going to go slower, faster, the same pace as you anticipated, because of all of this deal?
Well, I think Havieron will be, you know, will accelerate under our ownership. You know, we love Havieron. It's our original core asset. And, you know, we think it's just a world-class ore body. So, you know, you'll see us working on that ventilation very early in the piece. Then you'll see us kind of recommence that decline. You'll see us bring out the feasibility study. And I think that feasibility study will be really the first time we're able to share with our shareholders our full view on that asset, we've always been limited by Newcrest previous historically being the manager and having to work within the confines of their approach to the asset. We can now look at this in an unconstrained way, and we're really excited about that. Now, that excitement is no duplicate, no substitute for the work that needs to be done to finalise a feasibility study. So I'm not trying to front run that in any way, but we are excited about the opportunity it affords us to run our own feasibility study and really reimagine Havieron for first principles. Still taking advantage of all the good work that's been done, but really excited about showing how we imagine Havieron.
When do you imagine first ore out of Havieron?
So the timetable we have in the marketplace is calendar 25, deliver that feasibility study. Calendar 26 is first ore, but calendar 27 is first gold outturn. And the reason for that is because normally if you're a single mine, single asset company, your first teaspoon of ore, you take to the mill and you process it through. It commissions your mill. It's not super economic, but it gets the ball rolling. In this case, we're kind of confident we'll have Telfer ore. So if we can keep running Telfer on Telfer ore, we can stockpile that Havieron ore, and then we can do, once we're stoping and once we have a full ROM pad of Havieron ore, we can do a really economically efficient cutover where we campaign for 2 weeks, so a swing on site, Telfer ore, and then we campaign for 2 weeks, Havieron ore. And that's how we think you can optimize the site, not just over the next kind of 18 or 24 months, but actually over the full life of Havieron and Telfer. So that's how we envisage it. And I think the optionality of the ore in the ground at Havieron and Telfer give us the ability to do that optimization. And you don't normally get to do that optimization. So we're excited that we can do that in a way that a major would optimize the project.
And in your numbers in 2027, then, have you given the market a guide to how many ounces of gold you anticipate to produce with Telfer and Havieron, or that information is not available?
No, look, for now, we've just contained ourselves to 426,000 ounces gold equivalent in the first 15 months, which is basically the SRK project that is dependent on us completing the transaction in short order. So that's kind of where we start. And that was shared in our UK admission document in the SRK report. And then what we want to do is that study work that I described before, bring in that JORC resource, bring in that JORC reserve, finish the feasibility study, which will make Havieron. We'll be able to update the reserve with that. And then we'll be able to expand a more expansionary vision for Havieron Telfer, which is ultimately just the Telfer asset, but fed by the Telfer open pit, the Telfer underground, and the Havieron underground, and just the optimization of those three mines into Telfer, plus whatever can be added in the Paterson as we run a hub and spoke model for that infrastructure, which dominates the entire Paterson.
So that 426,000 ounces that you talked about, I mean, with a profit of $1,000 per ounce, if you like, in terms of maybe we shouldn't use profit, but cash flow positive, gives you 426 million. How's that going to affect the need for all the cash in Havieron?
So without talking to your numbers, what we like to think is if you can deliver, and there's no relax about the challenges in delivery, but we feel we have a team to do it successfully. If we can deliver free cash flow generation from Telfer across that 15-month mine plan, we build cash in our business. And what does that allow us to do? It allows us to de-gear. I appreciate we have no debt on the balance sheet post-transaction, but we do have that commitment letter for the $750 million Havieron project financing. If we can generate our own cash and not have to draw that debt, it allows us not to be geared, or at least lightly geared. If we can extend Telfer mine life, we can even reduce our gearing further. Yeah, our goal is to have the world's three most disappointed banks, where we don't need to use that facility or use it to the smallest extent possible. And then that accelerates our trip, not just to free cash flow, but to building up genuine cash in the bank and then accelerating our journey to being a dividend payer.
So it's going to be interesting. I mean, if you do get to the point where either you have very minimal debt to bring Havron into production or not, this will suddenly be quite an immense business, really. It will be just like a cash-producing machine.
Well, look, I think as soon as we complete this transaction, we make a splash. And I understand people are, you know, waiting to see us complete and fully de-risk what I think is a ripper of a transaction. But, you know, once we do that, we make a splash. We're a really meaningful producer just on Telfer alone. If we can extend that mine life, I think we demonstrate the ability to deliver more free cash flow. Then you bring on Havron, which is around 5 times higher head grade than Telfer. Well, that's just really attractive. Yeah, if we can de-gear that business and deliver that model quicker, this is a rare example of a confluence between a large existing mine that we're taking over in production with a world-class development asset, and potentially Telfer helps or funds Havron. It's a match made in heaven where you get to leverage that the same infrastructure to achieve two assets.
Well, then on top of that, I'm guessing all of that exploration you're doing, multiple drill rigs out there, is there another major find potentially? It's sort of a lottery ticket on top of the, you know, the cherry on top of the pie.
Yeah, look, the option value around the exploration, look, we're going to continue to invest in the drill bit. It's one of the three pillars of our or horizons of our strategy. We love that option value. And a couple of things gets added to that. Once you own the infrastructure, the cycle time and the CapEx bar is so much lower to bring a discovery into production. But also, we've just inherited, you know, this huge portfolio, which has been a bit unloved and a bit underexplored for the last decade. So bringing in these modern geophysical, you know, techniques to relook at that portfolio from first principles is a great opportunity. And that's why, you know, something like Chile is exciting. The fact that our team can peer through cover and identify mineralization, it's hard to know whether that mineralization is running 0.5% or 5 grams or half a gram or 5 grams. But the fact that we are consistently getting onto structures is hugely encouraging as we then grow into this much bigger portfolio and probably more rig spinning. So it sets us up for a higher probability of option of creating that option value.
It's good to see you continue, you know, exploring the other assets basically as you move into production.
Oh, look, it's doing both simultaneously. As Havron, as our shareholders perhaps know better than anyone, the best way to create value is to have exploration success. Now, you know, we're really excited about being a producer. That's going to be a focus for us. Yeah, you know, I've kind of missed being in a production company for the last 3 years, so I'm kind of excited about that prospect. But look, exploration is fantastic. And it takes me back to Northern Star. Yeah, you know, I think from memory of the 6 assets we purchased off our majors, 4 had a mine life of less than 12 months when Northern Star took them over. All 6 of those assets are still in production 10 years later. Well, therein is the opportunity. In this case, we've inherited a 15-month mine life. Plus, the icing on the cake is we have a 20-year mine life at Havron. So it's the table is set for success.
So, Sean, no, this is a gold story, and we shouldn't take away from this. The opportunity that there is copper at Telfer as well, is there a side issue there that you will get some copper as well that nobody's talked about? And obviously there's copper at Havron that we know of, but, you know, are we going to get some production in terms of copper from the Telfer as well?
Yeah, no, exactly right, Kevin. So, yeah, the both Havron and Telfer kind of share the same metallogenesis. They're very similar ore bodies, you know, mobilization of these fluids that have come out at 2 points 45 kilometers apart. So both are approximately 80% gold, 20% copper. So as soon as we take over Telfer, not only do we sell a gold doré, we also sell a copper gold concentrate as well. So we will be selling copper. And again, if I could pick 2 commodities today, it would be gold and copper. So delighted to have that in the short term and delighted to have it in the long term with Havron.
And is that 426 ounces of gold, including a copper credit or a copper credit's cherry
No,
on the top?
that is gold equivalent. So it's 426,000 ounces, including copper.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
Good.
Yeah, I
Well,
mean,
looks like you're on a winner, and good luck. And I'm sure things are all going smoothly. They want the thing to finish, I presume, and the whole transaction to complete just as much as you do. And yeah, good luck.
And the sun's shining in the background, Sean, as well. So I think you should go and get yourself a tinny and switch off for the weekend.
No, look, there's good alignment to get this transaction done, where that's our focus for it, and people should be confident we remain on track for a December quarter 2024 completion. So Phil, Kevin, Charles, appreciate the time as always, and the Sunday roast. Appreciate the engagement there, and look forward to chatting again.
Bye.
Cheers, Sean.
Great,
Bye
Sean.
now.
Enjoy your weekend, and
Bye-bye.
we'll speak to you shortly.
So let's move on to our second guest this week. We're joined by Leon Kurtz, the CEO of Jubilee Metals. Welcome back, Leon.
Hi Phil, thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've probably heard us obviously wax lyrical at the beginning about the news from the US, obviously the election news. I'd like to get your take on that news of obviously Trump being president and this sort of the immediate negative effect on metal prices we've witnessed.
Yeah, that's an interesting view, Phil. I suppose wanted to try and unpack what is emotion, speculation, and what is fundamental. I think there's very little fundamental direction or shift that has happened, and more emotion that has driven it. I think there was an expectation of a strong dollar and a correction in the metal price reflecting the strong dollar. And I don't think there's any fundamental direction that's been set yet.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, let's look at the the financial year 2025, where Jubilee reported a strong Q1 financial year, highlighting key advancements in Zambia and South Africa. In Zambia, Jubilee completed the commissioning of the Roan concentrator, achieving a stable production rate of 75,000 tons per month, with plans to reach 90,000 tons. This was bolstered by a new private power agreement, ensuring uninterrupted power supply. Open pit sites Munkoyo and Project G have ramped up operations, with Munkoyo hitting its mining target and Project G producing its first copper concentrate. For the full year, Jubilee aims for 6,000 tons of copper production. In South Africa, chrome output rose to 455,381 tons, and PGM production reached 9,328 ounces, both exceeding targets. You expressed optimism about Jubilee's expanded copper strategy and ongoing achievements across both regions. So, Leon, you must be happy with these results.
Are very much encouraged for, if you look at South Africa, yet again a stellar performance, exceeding guidance and comfortably on track to meet guidance and, potentially exceed guidance. We'll keep a close eye on that because, as we told, that's the growth that doesn't end there without the two new chrome modules coming into operation in the last part of this year. So it'll have a further impact on operations next year. And in Zambia, you're right. I mean, Zambia, critical milestones. First and foremost, to mirror the success in South Africa was let us to complete the processing capacity that was capitalized over the past few years, bring it into operation, have that processing footprint in Sable and in Roan, and then shift focus. And that is to fill that capacity with quality material that we have secured. And that's really where the focus now shifts. As you say, Roan ramped up, Sable producing, Munkoyo ramping up and hitting its targets, which is destined for Sable, Project G destined for Sable to take up that capacity, and then Roan ramping up to its full capacity. And yes, as you said, 75,000 tons is a stable run rate we're going to maintain for a couple of months before we step that up further at Roan. Big, big milestone. The power, fundamental. Few people understand the sheer crisis that on power that has happened or is still existing in Zambia, and wow, how important that was to be able to secure private power that is stable and reliable and has been effective since the 22nd of September. It was impossible to ramp up our operations prior to that because your power availability was unpredictable, and that has completely shifted since the 22 of September. So all the ingredients are now there to deliver on the copper. And what really excites me is if we then start looking at every quarter that now follows and you extrapolate forward from that quarter, you can see where we are heading to with our copper production, just based on what we have currently, before we expand Sable.
Yeah, very good. I mean, just to elaborate a little bit on that point, from what I gather, that the rains have started in Lusaka now, and you can probably confirm that after, you know, you've been there recently. But it's not going to be a case of just turning the rain on and getting the hydropower back. There's going to be a big backlog and deficit of power that's required. So having that private power agreement is going to give you a kind of an advantage over other companies in the area, presumably.
Fundamental point, yes, Phil. Even though the rains have started, I was there yesterday. It's wet. It's months before the backlog, as you put it, actually is caught up. It is, you know, a company without secured power is put in a very perilous position trying to chase production when copper is all about stability of your processes. Very much puts us in a very strong position.
Natalia, if you don't have electricity at a processing plant for a reasonable amount of time, how much damage? I mean, obviously, you go on care and maintenance. But how hard is it to start back up again in general, say a competitor that hasn't secured electricity?
Charles, exactly as you put it, it becomes particularly challenging if you try and run within that instability. Yeah. That's when damage is caused. It actually quite often is far better to just simply stop.
Just stop
focus
completely.
Focus on maintenance, yeah. Care and maintenance to then be ready for the restart. Because you're quite correct, you know, if refineries aren't made for crash stopping, smelters, which we don't have, are disastrous for crash stopping such operations. Everything, you know, when we speak about 80 or 90,000 tons, these are big flow rates going through your facility. No mechanical equipment is made to suddenly stop under load or even restart under load. I mean, that really is the knock-on impact beyond the fact that you can't make your quality of your copper plates because you're battling to maintain smoothness of metal, consistent plating of your metal. So there's many knock-on effects that follow.
So Leon, you gave us some production guidance for full year 2025. Just so people understand, what is your full year 2025, as in when does that finish?
Sure. So it's up to June next year. So if you look at our guidance and how we're producing, as planned in our guidance was a first quarter of ramping up, commissioning, addressing power, a second quarter of running up to stable production, and a third and fourth quarter delivering significant increased copper on the back of that operation. So it's a very much back-ended period. So your January to June period is significantly higher, as you can see in our numbers, in our copper output compared to the June to December number that we are in currently. And that's why if you take the forward quarter of January to March or the forward 6 months, as we've given, and you extrapolate that, you can see where we comfortably are heading towards a minimum expected copper output for the following period, if all things stay the same without us doing anything further or ramping up Project G, as we said, are all expanding Sable.
When we were there in Kabwe anyway, we saw the piles of the copper that were there. So, I mean, it's obvious that the copper's coming and it's going to start producing. I mean, if you manage to do the 7,500 tons, 7,500 tons at the current copper price is a considerable amount of revenue. No?
It's a very important point, Kevin, because yes, of course, it's the beauty of a metal such as copper that is such a high value metal. You know, we get, if you look at the revenue generated out of copper, how quickly it catches up to our South African business, which is sort of the anchor and the foundation of our financial performance. It shows how quickly copper catches up and exceeds our revenues and earnings from our current business. And the impact, therefore, that translates into earnings numbers are very, very significant.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with a guy yesterday when we were just talking about the present value of it. And I think if you do anywhere between these 5,800 and 7,500 tons of copper and the 1.65 million tons of chrome, then your actual revenue is significantly higher than your market capitalization at the moment.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think within a few months, your earnings are going to be, I mean, I think you're going to be on an earnings ratio of probably less than one if the market cap stays the same.
I mean, what the numbers show, Kevin, is exactly that fact that you had to, and yes, we've had some bruises and bumps, we had to lay the foundation to ensure that the capitalization phase, which is about putting the processing plants in place, is concluded successfully, then we had to ensure that the right resources are allocated and ramped up to utilize that capacity. That's done. So you are right. Translating that into earnings and into revenues, not that it's easy, but it is the easier part of the delivering the strategy than getting the various foundations and building blocks in place. You know, no one expected, we certainly did not expect, the critical need for full private power supply in Zambia. We thought we had addressed that through our offtake agreements and previously in Zambia. And it's these building blocks that are now put in place that, as even Charles and Phil mentioned, puts us actually at an advantage within the industry, because we've addressed areas fully that others are still facing to get their copper production out.
The RIH deal, it's almost not going to be required for you to get to the 25,000 tons, if I read these figures correctly, in terms of the upgrade of Project G and Munkoyo that we visited. So how on earth are you then going to, you know, produce even more?
Spot on, Kevin. I mean, the 25,000 tons target is in our sights of achieving definitely without the reliance on the large waste rock project. That is an additional two. And you are correct. That project requires its dedicated processing solution. There's no capacity left in our company to process that material. It's why, as part of that project and transaction, Rowan was such a critical component, because Rowan is basically a replica of the solution for that material. Because remember that Rowan's operational output, what it's running on as we speak, is in fact the previous mined material that was discarded into low-grade stockpiles, or overburden stockpiles, as they call it. So it is an exact replica, just at a smaller scale, of what that large waste project requires as a solution.
I know you're not sitting on your hands because you're in Zambia yesterday. Can we expect more projects? Can we expect more processing capacity to, you know, from the company over the next sort of 12 months?
What one can expect, as we said, irrespective of all the other options you've just put on the table, is now that we've shown and we've carved out in the copper market in Zambia, we've demonstrated the ability to take reefs that are shallow at surface and basically contains the copper that would have ended up in mined waste. We can take those projects and turn them into significant projects within 6 months. We have created a lane for our company that we would be failing our investors if we do not secure more of those opportunities now that we've unearthed and demonstrated those opportunities. And as we say in the update, we are already pursuing a further two such opportunities similar to the Munkoyos of the world to make sure that we capitalize on what our processing capability, what our research and development arm has proven, implemented, and now deliver copper on. And that is a very important focus that we continue. So in short, yes, one can expect that we will secure more similar resources as we put more and more pressure on our processing capacity. It would be a wonderful problem to be in, which we don't see too far into the future, where we make too much copper high-grade concentrate to actually refine. And we are starting to trade that into the market to then have the decision, are we expanding refining capacity or are we simply capitalizing on the copper we sell to partnered refineries? And that's the future we expect in our group to reach.
Very good. Yeah. I mean, having witnessed it in Zambia ourselves, obviously the last visit, we can see with the guidance also of Rickus, who is a very switched on guy, and we can see that he's very focused, actually almost turning it into a very focused business that will, you know, be fixed on producing profit. I mean, I think that's what we got from him, and he's I think you've got a good operation going now in Zambia, which before, if we're absolutely honest, you were hoping it was going to work. Now we know it's going to work. And I think that's the difference.
Oh, absolutely, Kevin. Before, we were very clear on the strategy. We knew what had to be done, but it was in many cases still strategy. And, you know, it's easy to put a strategy sometimes on PowerPoint. To make copper is a very different thing. And putting all of those building blocks in place has been a critical path for us. And you are right. Now those blocks are in place, it shifts into being a business, not a developing strategy for the group. And yes, there were many lessons learned along this way. But in those lessons, one thing that is clear is people underestimate the barrier of entry to make a ton of copper. It puts you at such an advantage to companies who talk of making copper compared to a company who is making copper and expanding.
I think one thing that struck me, Leon, was when we went to Rowan Concentrator is the DMS, the dense medium separation that you've installed there, which really impressed me in the technologies and how it was explained. But just talk the listeners through just how important, you know, when we think Jubilee, we think the Jubilee way, the processing,
yes,
and the sort of, let's say, the old-fashioned way. But just talk how through this use of physics that you've employed with the DMS, yeah, is important going forward, and how you've kind of got over that challenge. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely, Phil. It really mirrors what we do in South Africa. In fact, yesterday I had a debate with a very large company in Zambia to educate companies on the fact what really distinguishes us is that we harness physics on this material to make it valuable to extract the copper out of more of a traditional process. That's always been the key distinguishing factor of Jubilee. It is why we can go to low-grade piles of rock, many millions big, and we're able to apply physics accurately to take that rock pile and turn it into a very valuable, upgraded rock pile for further recovery. So that's the unlocking factor. And what this kind of technology, of which the DMS is one part of that solution, does, it means, for in a lack of technical words, is we have a filter in front of our plant. So no matter what variability comes in, we filter out that variability to ensure we make a high-grade copper product, which is fed into the next refining step. And that's the distinguishing factor. It brings in a flexibility into your process that other companies don't have. It is why we can pursue materials other companies would frown upon, is because we're able to turn that variability into a consistent feed supply.
Yeah. So the quality that you put in is very important, and you're removing things like the gang, as they call it, and all those sort of things. It's all about good quality in, good quality out.
Oh, very much. There's many knock-on effects. Exactly, Phil. I'm really impressed by your understanding. Is beyond upgrading the copper into our process, we're also removing that part that actually adds no value, but simply eats chemicals. So it's a dual effect. We do said what we then process, even if it was to be at a similar copper grade than another company, it's far cheaper for us to process it because we've removed in that process things that don't add value but simply cost.
I've got a follow-up technical question on this. So this leaching that you're planning, the heat leaching.
Yes.
The first thing is it tends to take a fair bit of time to put this into place, generally over a few months. So you're probably not going to see much benefit from it, potentially until the next financial year, would be my guess. But I mean, the bigger question is, are you potentially trialing this to replace the hub concentrators?
Excellent question, Charles. The answer is no, don't replace it. What it is what our technical team has shown is that in this ability to filter out what goes into the next process, we are also able to take what remains and filter that into a group of copper that remains on site that is perfectly suited for that heap leaching approach.
Okay.
Heap leaching has been trialed and attempted and used by many, many companies. And one of the key failures of that approach was an all-in approach. You cannot provide or assume that all of what you've got you can apply to all in any technology or any process. It is what we do. We've recovered and isolated a component of copper that adds tremendous further copper value to the process that we can, in fact, apply that. But you would need, in any event, your hub approach. It's the hub that makes that component of
material. How much higher percentage are you recovering from your initial copper by adding in the heat leach stage? Because effectively what you're saying is it's effectively a pile of waste tailings almost from what you already have at lower grade. So how much more copper are you going to get out by applying heat leaching?
Oh,
is it like 5-10% more or significant?
No, it's quite a significant jump. So because remember, in the waste or the discarded material we process, there's a component of copper that's not recoverable through the technical or typical processes. This is what this leaching addresses. So you're adding nearly 10 to 12% additional on top of what you produce.
Okay, well, that is that's big news. Possibly not. Yeah, maybe dragging those numbers out of you. I didn't see them in the RNS. 10-12%.
No, so Charles, our approach is quite simple. You know, let's deliver on the numbers we've given the market. The large scale trials are kicking off at Munkoyo, as we said, in fact, as we speak, and those numbers as they come out, we'll start providing that to the market on the impact that has both on Rowan, Munkoyo, which is potentially very significant. It's the last component of process development that also fully addresses the large waste project. It is the last piece of puzzle that then completes how do you process material that is previously regarded as off-spec or low-grade or overburden, like we do today as common in South Africa on chrome.
Yes, and the very second you complete that puzzle, every competitor in the world is going to come after you, presumably.
Yes. So Leon, taking it away from technical and just bringing it back to pound notes, rands, kwacha, whatever you want to call it, effectively, you're at the beginning now of a time where 2025 figures are going to show a very healthy profit in terms of both copper, chrome, and the PGMs. And we haven't really even talked about if PGM prices start to perk up, which is a definite possibility, that you're going to have a very nice situation. But full year 2026, you could be in a situation where 25,000 tons of copper are actually produced. I'm not suggesting you agree or disagree with that, but this will fundamentally change the financial position of Jubilee Metals, because the copper will actually be producing more revenue and more free cash flow than the chrome. Is that a fair summation?
Okay, and factually true that copper has the potential to produce significantly higher revenues and free cash flow than chrome, just sheer value per ton that you produce. And also the fundamental difference between the two companies, being our chrome and our copper side, is that we own the resources, well, most of the resources we process. We're not just processing within partnerships in chrome. It's a big lesson we learned is as we unlock the value of the resources people had thought were valueless, is to act fast to secure those resources so that the benefit accrues more to the company who actually unlocks the potential than to the company who holds the resources.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for coming on, Leon. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for appearing on the podcast. We'll say Leon Kurtz, CEO of Jubilee Metals. Thanks very much for your time.
Arno, thank you for the opportunity.
Well, let's move on to some of the movers and shakers this week. I think the best mover I've recorded on here was Zentra, up some 90%. I don't know much about the stock myself. And then the biggest loser of the week, or the shaker, was Hummingbird Resources. It's down some 70%. Now, Charles, I know you've talked about this one in the past, but just talk us through the rationale behind this sort of drop and sell-off.
Well, the basic point is that there's one is the debt, which, you know, always doesn't help. But the other is that they're actually the cost, they're all the sustaining costs, their cost of the producing the gold is more than what they're selling the gold for, even with gold at, you know, effectively record prices. So I wouldn't blame the management in particular, because I think they had a run of kind of bad luck, which you do this sometimes get. But at the end of the day, the under the current management, under the current finances that they have, it's just not a viable operation. They need someone to come in and take it over. And yes, this is a huge, you know, haircut in terms of on the share price. But actually, the alternative was it just went into bankruptcy.
Yeah.
So that's that. I do think that people investing, you know, in Hummingbird, I do feel sorry for them. But I also feel that there were enough red flags and warnings running into this. Unlike other companies that have just, you know, horizontal minerals, which no one saw come, well, few people saw coming, for example. With this one, most people should have seen what was going to happen, in my opinion.
Yeah, and there was another one this week, and again, I want your takes on this, was Codal Minerals, wasn't it, where they effectively announced some bizarre... I mean, how on earth a company could not know that they are effectively liable for this? Was it 30 million or something, or 15 million? I can't remember the exact figure, but it was a very large number that was expressed. So I want
it was it was. I mean, in terms of perspective, I mean, it was sort of like half of $15 million or something. I mean, it's not that much money. The issue is the lack of trust now between the partners potentially. Yeah. This is because in these kind of contract things where you disagree about a contract, and we're talking about, I think it was like $120 million was the deal. And yeah, the total value of this like disagreement was say 7.5 or 15 or whatever it happened to be. You just get into a meeting behind closed doors and hash it out. That's what you do, right? And the fact that they haven't done that potentially signifies bigger problems. Now, that's one issue. The thing is with it as well is the Chinese are very good at offering money, but if you show any sign of weakness, they cannot be the greatest partners in terms of acting in good faith, as we all know. And your bigger problem with Kodal was that they said they'd have production in this quarter. It's now been pushed out to next quarter, and you're sensing a little bit of deja vu there. And yet, having said that, the size of the asset they have at Bugini, it is massive. There's an opportunity to make a massive amount of capital. But their next-door neighbours, which was Leo Lithium, effectively had to sell out dime on the dollar to the Chinese, a different Chinese partner, because of what I would view as similar regulatory and financial issues. And my question is whether Hainan is trying to do exactly the same thing and what Bernard, the CEO, has done to prevent this from happening. But yeah. I don't know. It's tricky.
I do not understand how Kodal cannot have been consulted by Hainan on the announcement of this effectively, this $15 yeah. million dollar payment was due to the Mali government. For me, that is a red flag in terms of communication. It's a yeah, communication 100%. Breakdown. It's a yeah. trust issue.
It's a trust. Exactly what I'm saying. It's not the actual amount of money. It's the trust. And then the question is, okay, this gets dealt with. But then this is a partnership that's meant to last for the next sort of decade or so, right? Potentially longer. So you have to, right? On the flip side of that, what I will say is that Kodal shares are, you know, the market cap's around £70 million, which is yeah. less than what the, you know, the dollar term of the deal that's been signed. So this might be a very attractive dip, given that the production is meant to be happening next quarter. Yeah. So you have to weigh these things up. But, you know, as a general rule, I stay out of Mali because I just don't believe in the jurisdiction. Yeah. It's safe yeah. enough.
It's pretty, yeah, it's not a great jurisdiction. But I mean, I think the shares bounced back some. They were about, at one point, 30 to 40% down on the day. And I think they ended yeah. the week around about 14, 15%. So there was quite a good recovery.
I don't know. I don't want to compare it to Premier African Minerals because it's its own thing. But it's a similar, very, I would say, for the jurisdiction, it's high risk, high reward. And therefore, I don't think it's a smart idea to have it as a core portfolio stock where you're throwing all your money at it. But I do think that a lot of people are looking at the price level now, or at that earlier dip, as you were saying, we're looking at that and going, hang on, this is quite a good deal or potentially a good trade. Yeah. But yeah, it's. I hope they work it out, though, because they put a lot of work into this company. And I think it's well run, it's well managed. Hopefully this is just a hiccup that can be dealt with.
Yeah, I don't think much happened this week, to be honest. It was more a macro week, wasn't it, than a yeah. micro week. And yeah, it's just one of those things. But yeah, I think the guests we've had today in terms of Jubilee and Greatland Gold, wow, they've both got a lot of potential, I think, and that should be coming to fruition in the next 12 to 24 months, where we see big upside in terms of their financials if they execute. And yeah, will that translate into share price? Let's hope so.
Yeah, so then we also saw news on Friday from BSF Enterprise that they effectively report solid progress across the various portfolio of assets, particularly in the lab-grown leather LGL, where it remains the only producer of the 100% lab-grown scaffold-free leather. LGL recently supplied samples to luxury brands and an automotive manufacturer, which obviously marks significant steps towards commercialization. 3D BioTissues launched its CytoBoost trademark media additive, which has gained substantial interest from biopharma firms for improving cell growth and post-cryostorage revival. BSF continues to explore cultivated meat technologies and has reallocated resources to focus on high potential projects. So, yeah, what did you make of that? I mean, this seems to be the focus now is obviously moving on to the lab-grown leather. It's great to see that I think they've supplied 3 out of the top 5 luxury brands in the world. What are your thoughts on this, where this could go?
Well, I think the thing is with the pivot away from meat, the meat will come back, as in the replacement meat, when the interest rates come down, because you need that cheap debt in order to be able to sell the products at an effective price, right? And you don't need to look at the, you know, just BSF. This is not, the company's fault, maybe in particular. The corn parent, Marlow Foods, they just announced a huge loss, like over £60 million a couple of months ago. It last made a profit in 2021 when the rates were low, right? Most of them, Beyond Meat and all the others, they just haven't done well. So yes, they've pivoted. But the important point to understand is it's the City Mix supplement, which is the game changer for BSF. It's got huge advantages. You've got these production yields are pretty high. It's fairly cheap to produce. There's no animal cruelty. You don't need, plant-based scaffolds or blenders or fillers that kind of make things, look or taste artificial. And this pivot into the leather part market, it is the right idea. I mean, back in, it was May 2023, wasn't it? So it was a fairly long while ago. And they bioengineered samples of animal skin tissue measuring 10 by 10 centimeters, right? And so, not small. And this was like a huge milestone. And now, but and then it was in February this year, they announced it partnered with Maison Amélie Pichard, the world's first fashion accessory using lab-grown leather. So again, and then last year, again, it was exactly the same thing as you say, major multinational leather fashion companies partnerships. So, okay, is this a tiny market cap company? Yes. Have they spent way more money than what their market cap is? Yes. So fundamentally, it's good value. The global leather goods market was $253 million in 2023, expected to be $405 billion by 2030. So you're looking at a situation where they only need to carve out a very small amount of that market. And I don't like that argument generally, but at the same time, it's a disruptor. It's not another leather company coming to disrupt the leather market. It's a leather replacement company coming to help the leather market. And I suspect, and I hope anyway, that these partnerships that they're currently have in place will be a way to generate profit.
Yeah, whoever it happens to be, I mean, there's three of five, isn't there? So
We
you've got
could
maybe a
name them. We could, yeah.
Chanel, Hermes,
Yeah.
LVMH, is it? Louis Vuitton, which is part of LVMH, I think. Who Cartier, whoever it happens to be, three of the five of them are now looking at this going, ooh, this is a piece of leather, and it's real leather, and it smells like leather, and it looks like leather, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think at the current market valuation of this company, it's ridiculous. I mean, it was in the 20p plus range and a market cap four or five times what it is now, only a year plus ago. And that was obviously based on the meat, which I did taste and I did see, which isn't going to happen straight away. But as Charles said, the City Mix is the thing that they're going to be able to scale and actually get some financial from this. And now this other product, which is a slightly different way of using City Mix that they've called something else, and they
Cyto
can
boost.
Cyto Boost. Cyto Boost, which means it
Cyto
boosts the
boost. Get your
site.
Cyto boost.
And the profit margin on this Cyto Boost is much, much higher. So maybe they don't sell as much of it, but ultimately they're not producing a huge amount at the minute. But it seems like it's been a way of ratcheting up those revenues by adapting the product that they have,
Yeah.
while they get a situation with the leather. I mean, what is going to happen if one of the companies turns around and say, right, we want this, we want your priority technology, and we want to be the only ones that have it, because that's the way these houses will
Yeah,
work. One
exactly.
of them will say, I want it. Okay, here's some millions to say. We are the only people that can have it for the next 3 years
10
or
years or
five
whatever,
years.
yeah.
And what's BSFA going to be worth, or Three Radical going to be worth, or whatever they've called the leather scenario going to be worth when that happens? And they say, we want you to produce X thousand meters of leather, or we will use it to produce X thousand meters of
They'll
leather.
just license the technology, won't they, and do it
Yeah.
themselves.
So
Yeah, but
what's it going to be worth then?
yeah,
I mean,
a lot. Yeah,
it's going to
it's
be worth a lot. So it definitely, and I don't think that's, and I genuinely don't think that's an if or a but. I think that is a when, because
yeah.
I think this technology is impressive. I think it's going to be, there or thereabouts in terms of the companies using it. It ticks every sort of ethical box that people want. But they still want the leather, don't they? Nobody
Yeah.
wants to not have leather. But
No.
if I have this ethical leather instead of, and it's trademarked with something that says, No animal was killed
And
to
at
produce
scale
this.
is cheaper potentially as well. At the moment it'll be more expensive, but as it gets bigger, cheaper. I mean, on top of that, I mean, the other thing is the corneal tissue engineering. I mean, they've called it into something, Dorato. Now, is it early days? Yes, but they're partnered with a couple of universities, Newcastle and Montreal. Corneas is probably, it's the most frequently transplanted human tissue worldwide. Everybody needs their eyes, right? And effectively, they just inject their treatment into the tissue, and it supports the healing and of the surface of the eye. And the idea is that it reduces the cost of treatment significantly, and also improves the outcomes. Now, we all know, and we've all seen what happens when a biotech approach, a novel biotech approach, works. The share price explodes. Now, we're not saying that will definitely happen, or that that it's likely to happen. Just that's another thing to keep an eye on. There's so many strings to the bow here that one of them should take off, whether it's the meat or the liver or the eyes or et cetera, et cetera.
Very good. Okay, so what about the there was an announcement on interest rate cuts. Was it 0.25 points or 25 base points, however you want it to, down to 4.75? What are your thoughts on that? I mean, it was pretty much as expected, right?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is this budget that we've got from the wonderful Rachel Reeves is inflationary, right? And the Bank of England literally said did anything they could to say that, but say that it was inflationary, even though that was the obvious implication. So we've cut the interest rates because we felt that they had to. I suspect if they hadn't put out that prior messaging, then they would have just kept it at five, but they had to. Otherwise, it would have spooked the markets. Inflation goes back up next year, and they might have to put it back up again. We don't know. And then if Trump's going to be inflationary as well, then almost certainly. But I mean, the fun thing is obviously is the messaging around the budget means that mortgages, for example, on the day mortgage rates actually rose because people were expecting fewer cuts slash increases in the future potentially. So I don't know. I think it hasn't, in terms of the money market, it made virtually no difference at all.
I think mortgage rates are set to follow in the coming weeks, but that remains to be seen. So, I mean, on a lighter note, times like this where it can get a bit too much, there is some escapism out there. I've been watching this new I don't know if you've seen it, Charles, but it's fascinating. This new crime drama based on real life. It was called Lucan, and it's the viewers follow Neil Berryman, who's effectively a builder from Hampshire, I think. And he's effectively the son. He found out he's the son of Sandra Rivett. Sandra Rivett was the nanny that was murdered by Lord Lucan 50 years ago. And he basically just embarks on a hunt to find the vanished aristocrat. Obviously, it made the news. People joke about, oh, you're doing a Lord Lucan on us. But it is a very fascinating. He goes off to Australia and potentially meets Lord Lucan, or he did in 2012. And there's video footage of him going in and meeting him. And it's just, honestly, it's one of the most compelling real life drama documentaries. The way it's filmed, you've got to hunt it out. It's on iPlayer right now. Three-parter. So I urge listeners, anyone who's interested in that sort of thing, to listen. You've got The Penguin on, which is obviously the Batman offshoot series, which is on Sky Atlantic, and also The Jackal has just started as well. So there's three pieces of viewing for you there if anyone's interested. Anything else going on the sports arena, Kev? I see Liverpool are flying away and doing extremely well. Got to say,
top of the Champions League, top of the Premier League. What more can we say other than if we're not there at the top of it at the end, I'll be very disappointed. But who knows?
Looking good.
Who knows? We're doing well. Did you see that Aston Villa loss against Bruges?
Yes, Bruges, wouldn't
it? So basically, the keeper kicked it to him, and he goes and picks the ball up. Gives penalty, and he picks it up, puts it down again on the spot, and the ref goes. It happened in an Arsenal game last year as well against Bayern Munich, I think it was, and the Bayern players were going mental because the Arsenal player had basically picked the ball up, but the ref didn't give it. He just waved them away and they put the ball down and kicked it. But this time, no, obviously there must have been. I mean, it was obviously just a mistake. He thought the boy was passing it to him, but to take the goal kick. But yeah, what a disaster that was for Villa.
Yeah,
The mood
United
on
won,
that.
didn't they? They finally got a result. Was it PAOK? Diallo scored, but I didn't really see too much. But anyway, what else has been going on? I mean, Charles, you got anything on this weekend?
What, in terms of personal life? No, not really.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't particularly well earlier this week, so just catching up on work generally. But also, it's November in Devon. Like the beaches are closed, the mountain biking is over. We don't do anything for about 6 months unless we're going on holiday. But I don't know. No, I know it sounds like a bit of a downer, but no, to be honest, I mean, I was saying this to you guys before we went on there. We do a lot of junior resource stuff. So it's actually really busy at the moment. And then, half the world just stops mining from December, January, February, March. Then we have a bit of a quiet period. That's when we tend to take a bit of time off. So hopefully at that point, yeah.
Well, I look forward to seeing you in the city coming up. We've got a few events coming up. We've got the Master Investor
Oh.
Show, which we'll all be at, and we've obviously got a few other things coming up with IPO. So we'll catch up for
That's going
sure.
to be super fun. Yeah. Perfect.
Good.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, have a great weekend. Obviously, everybody,
Yeah, I'm
thanks for
off to the
listening.
Mediterranean, so I'll see you there.
Ah, very good. Not
Should be
surprised, but
very
yeah,
good.
thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe. Hit the bell icon for future notifications of any further episodes. Have a great weekend, all.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.